ABC News with Rachel Papazzoni. American media is reporting that US stealth bombers have dropped 40 bombs on a major Libyan airfield as air attacks resume against Colonel Gaddafi's forces. As Foreign Affairs editor Peter Cave reports from Tobruk, the Libyan leader has gone on state television, defiantly promising the West a long war.
Colonel Gaddafi spoke by phone from the relative safety of his bunker, which is surrounded by volunteer human shields. He said he'd opened his arsenals to the people of Libya. "We promise you a long, drawn-out war with no limits," he said. "You are not prepared for a long war in Libya. This is a very happy moment we're living. All tyrants fall under the pressure of the populist masses. America, France or Britain, the Christians that are in a pact against us today, they will not enjoy our oil. You are aggressors," he said. "You are animals." Peter Cave, ABC News, Tobruk.
The Japanese media is reporting that two people have been found alive in the rubble from the earthquake and tsunami in northeastern Japan. Mark Simkin reports from Tokyo.
Japan's national broadcaster says an 80-year-old woman and a 16-year-old boy were found in the city of Ishimaki, 9 days after an earthquake and tsunami devastated the region. The survivors apparently responded to the calls of a police search and rescue team and were then pulled from the rubble. The pair are reported to be conscious but in a weak condition. Yesterday, reports of a separate miracle rescue turned out to be based on misinformation. Mark Simkin, ABC News, Tokyo.
About 2,000 protesters have demonstrated in Taiwan, demanding an immediate halt to the construction of a nuclear power plant. The flag-waving and chanting protesters demanded that work on the island's fourth nuclear power plant, which is nearly complete, be halted immediately. The project has been marred by controversy since the government scrapped the partially built plant in 2000 and then reinstated it the following year at a huge extra cost. The demonstrators are also opposed to plans to extend the lifespan of three existing nuclear plants. Police are investigating an explosion in Perth that injured 5 people, including a 4-year-old child. It's believed the explosion was caused by a clandestine drug lab. All of the injured have been taken to Royal Perth Hospital. 3 have severe burns. The organised crime unit will continue to examine the scene through the night. A man has been airlifted from Hamilton Island in North Queensland with a suspected Irukandji jellyfish sting. He was stung in the water at Whitehaven Beach and has been transferred to Mackay Base Hospital. Police are looking for a motorcyclist who was involved in a hit and run involving a child on the New South Wales mid-north coast. Police say a 7-year-old boy was playing with his 2 brothers when he was knocked unconscious after being hit by the bike in Wingham about midday. The child is in John Hunter Hospital in Newcastle with a fractured skull. The people of Haiti are due to vote in the second round of presidential elections as the country battles a growing cholera epidemic. Voters will be choosing between a former senator and a musician who's never held public office. The BBC's Andy Gallagher reports from Port-au-Prince.
The 2 candidates who've made it through Haiti's troubled elections couldn't be more distinct. Michel Martelly is a former pop singer known as Sweet Mickey. He's been drumming up support through concerts and is known for his brash style of politics. His opponent, Mélande Manigat, is a matronly former First Lady with an academic background. But the presence of former President Aristide could play a decisive role, despite the fact he can't run. An endorsement from him could boost either candidate.
Prince William has addressed a fundraising gala for disaster victims in Brisbane. Karen Binney's there.
Prince William was greeted by more than 100 screaming fans when he arrived at the event. He gave them a wave before heading inside. 285 people paid $500 a head for tonight's function, with proceeds going to the Premier's relief fund. Prince William has toured disaster-hit North Queensland and the state's southeast over the past 2 days.
Everywhere I've been, the mood has been one of optimism, with Queenslanders very much open for business.
He also thanked the people who helped in the aftermath of the disasters. When he left the function, he greeted those who'd waited outside to say hello. Tomorrow, he heads to Victoria. Karen Binney, ABC News, Brisbane.
To the weather now. For Sydney, 23 and rain. Rain also in Melbourne, 23. Showers for Brisbane, 29. In Perth, sunny and 32. Showers for Adelaide, 22. Showers in Hobart, 21. Rain for Canberra, also 21. And in Darwin, 32, with showers and an afternoon storm. For more news, go to abc.net.au.
What we need is driver education. It's just crazy. It's ludicrous, you know, to be bumper to bumper at 100k.
Could not agree more, mate. You drive safer today.
Breakfast with Adam Spencer.
A lot of listeners to this show at the moment have the full chain of command. You might have, so you've got your female Lord Mayor, then your local member, then your state premier, then your governor, then your, the full thing.
On 702.
Pale male and stale board members.
Pale male and stale.
Yeah.
You're asking us to rail against the pale male and stale.
Thanks, Adam.
ABC Sydney.
Let me introduce you to a new segment of the program that we'll be featuring over the coming months. A little signpost to things local and things national and international of what's going on with religion and the world. One of the big issues over recent years has been discussions of welfare reform and how should the poor be treated in our society. And central to that has been concerns by many that access to the law has once again become a privilege rather than a right. In response to that, a few months ago, or a year or so ago now, a young solicitor called Luke Geary decided something should be done, and he and the Salvation Army got together and have set up a new legal aid organisation dubbed Salvos Legal. Luke, welcome to the program. We were talking a couple of months ago, really, about, or before Christmas, about what you were doing and how Salvos Legal got set up. Let's just recap on that very briefly. Give us the sort of two-minute version.
Sure. There's two separate law firms that the Salvation Army owns and runs. One is called Salvos Legal Humanitarian, and that's pretty much the same sort of thing as Legal Aid, except we don't draw on any government funding. We advise people and we assist them, and in many cases we represent them in courts and tribunals in the areas of criminal law, family and children's law, debt, housing, Centrelink matters, and a lot of migration and refugee law. We run that across five offices, which are located in Auburn, Campsie, Miranda, Parramatta and Surry Hills.
So it's mainly around Sydney at the moment. You've started out of a Sydney base.
Correct.
Yep.
And I guess the unique thing about Salvos Legal Humanitarian is we harness not only employees but a wide range of volunteers. So our team consists of around about 80 solicitors and migration agents and paralegals. Wow. And to date, we've serviced around 2,200 clients, all for free in those areas of the law.
So humanitarian, one side. Now, what's the other side of the operation?
The other side, and it's quite an exciting thing, specifically for the Salvation Army. It's a world first for the Army. Is something called Salvos Legal, and that's a commercial law practice for paying clients who can who need to see a solicitor in areas of property law and conveyancing, wills and estates, and some migration law. And so those people who have got the money and who want to have a conveyance done by a solicitor or a conveyancer, instead of going to any other private law firm, they can come to Salvos Legal. And the special thing about that is all the money that they spend on the conveyance, and it doesn't cost them anything else in addition to what they'd pay if they went somewhere else, all the money they spend goes to fund that free law for the people who can't otherwise afford it.
Oh, so it's a bit like ethical investing. That is, you know, I come along and use Salvos Legal as my law firm, and the profits then go not to the pockets of the fabulously wealthy lawyers,
precisely,
but to the poor and
the
cases.
No Ferraris and no Porsches here, that's for sure. It's a 100% not-for-profit law firm.
Okay, let's talk then about hard business. One of the things that people constantly get caught on these days. Let's talk about a broad area of interest to almost everybody who walks into a shop these days: consumer law, and the little sort of tricks and traps that people fall into when they come against the great and brilliant world of trade and commerce today. Let's go to a quite simple thing. You go into a shop, you buy something, or perhaps even more these days, you order online something, and you get it and you find it isn't what you were thought it was. Either it's a different product or a damaged product or not quite the product you thought, and you try and return it.
Mm.
Buyer beware?
Well, I guess, yeah, caveat emptor was the Latin maxim for that. But I think there's a few elements in that, John. Sometimes people want to get a refund or a change simply because they've made the wrong decision. Perhaps it was in the heat of the moment and they're no longer excited about the product. Alternatively, it might be that the thing that they bought doesn't do what they thought it would, or simply it just doesn't work. So dealing with them one at a time, people commonly think they can get a refund for simply a change of mind, or if they bought the wrong thing, or if, for example, the item of clothing purchased doesn't fit. Now, one would hope that shops would accommodate people in those circumstances, but as a strict matter of law, it's a misunderstanding by individuals who are consumers. Businesses, in fact, are not obliged to give refunds for the change of mind a person might make.
So it's not like sort of real estate where you get a 7-day cooling off period or something.
No,
like
it's
that.
Not. Yeah. The only circumstances where you can get a refund for change of mind is where the store specifically has a policy or a guarantee that offers a refund, replacement or a credit note where that happens. And so that's sort of an extra term of the contract that the individual has with that store, but there's no safety net as such in the law.
So buyer beware really does apply.
Indeed.
In those circumstances.
Indeed, in those circumstances it does.
What about where maybe it's slightly flawed or it's not quite what you thought it was, you know?
Yeah, definitely. That's a very different area, and certainly the law provides for refunds to be given in certain circumstances, and that might consist of if the goods are faulty or have got defects that were not obvious to the purchaser when they bought them, if the goods are unfit for purpose, which means that they don't do what they're supposed to do, or if the goods don't match the description, the sample, or the demonstration model that they were shown.
What general rights would consumers have then in these sorts of circumstances?
Well, they can have recourse to one of a number of remedies. They can seek a refund, they can seek a credit note or replacement of the item. But I guess getting down to it, there's a few things that people need to be aware of. In terms of getting a refund, the person needs to make sure that they return the goods within what's called a reasonable time of purchase. And the reason for that is that the shop can understand specifically the bona fides of what the person is saying and accept that and then deal with the matter reasonably. The person who wants to return the goods obviously should not lose, destroy or damage the item. And one thing that people should try to do is, where possible, make sure that they maintain their proof of purchase. Obviously, that's evidence of the contract having been made, and without it, given goods are often sold in various places for various different prices, a lot of issues would arise.
If you've got a store, you can use a bit of moral suasion too. It doesn't come into law. That is, you can say, well, look, your store has a reputation to maintain. Mm. I mean, so there's the normal sort of argy-bargy you can use, and that really depends on leaning on the sense of the proprietor may have about their reputation and wanting to preserve it.
Yeah, certainly. Consumers are powerful in that respect in that they vote with their dollar, and a good proprietor will be one who respects that. And certainly the larger retailers or those who might not be so large but certainly value the customers that they have and the loyalty of those people have those extra terms offered that we will give a refund within 48 hours or 7 days or whatever. And that's an extra bonus part of their contract with the consumer.
What advice would you generally give to listeners who they may not be well off and they've really got to be careful about purchases these days?
I think there's two things. One is that they certainly need to be aware that stores don't have a legal obligation to refund for change of mind. Secondly, if the individual is unsure about the suitability of an item, they need to check the store policy before they make the purchase. That way they know they're covered.
Yeah, so some stores say, we will give you a refund if you're unsatisfied and
precisely.
Whatever, and you look for those stores.
Yeah, definitely. But I guess in terms of things which might be of graver significance to people, so such as if they buy something and it doesn't work, they need to recognise that they are protected by the law and they shouldn't be afraid of enforcing the legal rights. If goods are faulty or defective, then the individual has rights that they can enforce through the supplier, through the retailer, or through the manufacturer.
Now, let's take an anecdote from perhaps a different area where you've got the question of say, debt. And people can, for all sorts of reasons these days, people can get into all sorts of debt they don't expect. You can find yourself, say, with a person losing their job, debts build up. These are common stories we hear every day. We were talking about financial counselling just a couple of weeks ago on this program. Banks are again in the gun. We've heard lots of criticism of banks recently. If you were dealing with people who come to you and say, look, the big end of town is out to get us. We've got a debt problem with the bank and they are really coming down hard. We heard these stories during the drought. We heard these stories. There are issues of people with the floods in Queensland, of how they're dealing with not consumer shop trading.
I don't like this. Business, I want to get out. We're dealing with big stories
here. Yeah, look, at Salvo's Legal, we deal with some people who are in the most vulnerable of situations. Certainly we deal with farmers who have got issues arising from the drought, but also we deal with certainly elderly people who come to us and through, I guess, optimism on their part, they've been able to go to a bank and borrow a significant amount of money. They've done so with the hope that they can assist in giving themselves a little bit of a greater retirement. But I guess they did it without any real advice and without reading the fine print of the documentation. So consumer debt can be significant. I remember this sort of brings to light a story of a couple of clients I had a little while ago. And they were very, very old. They were a husband and wife who'd been together, married for over 60 years. So you can imagine they were a little bit old. And the husband was 89 years old and he was a little bit ill. The wife, she had a great heart and a great spirit and she was a big fighter and she always looked after him. But she was only a couple of years younger than he was. So both of them, no family other than each other, no children to support them, no advisors to help them at the time of entering into the agreement. They presented to me with a letter from one of the main banks demanding $80,000 back from them, which they'd loaned to them. The lady who was part of the partnership, the husband and wife partnership, she had a condition which contributed to what we might describe as hoarding. So she'd squandered the money quite sadly, and it hadn't, you know, been invested in anything of value. So the money the bank had loaned was gone. Now, what was quite, I guess, sympathetic to us when we looked at the matter, not only was the age and the situation of these two who wanted nothing but to be left alone and to live their own lives together, was that the documentation they showed us was signed by a bank manager and approved by the manager's supervisor, so quite high up at the bank, unsecured, and it was a loan for a period of 25 years. So if you think about it, even at the younger of the two, the loan wouldn't be paid back until she was at least 110 years old. And so, look, there is a code of conduct that financial institutions have to follow. And
you mean they can be shamed?
Well, but this story, I suppose, John, wouldn't want to shame them because they did the right thing in this instance. And the reason they did that was because at the appropriate levels of decision-making, the bank was persuaded that really the circumstances in which the money was loaned probably shouldn't have ever passed. And the elderly couple were fortunately given a waiver of the debt. So they were able to get on with their lives without this incredible burden over their heads. But certainly, I guess, for them, a lesson learned, and hopefully for the bank as well.
But surely there were some errors made on the part of the bank there.
Yeah,
certainly
definitely.
Certainly by the loan officer engaged
definitely.
Or involved.
I mean, the husband and wife signed a certificate saying that they didn't want any advice on the loan. So I guess in terms of the bank, they were strictly entitled to take that if they wanted to. But to be fair to an elderly couple who come in asking to borrow a significant amount of money, one would hope that a moral compass would direct that person to asking them some more questions or perhaps seeking them away for some more advice first.
A solution like that did rely for its outcome on senior executives in the bank acceding that there was a moral compass involved.
They did, certainly a moral compass, not necessarily a legal one. So their decision to waive the debt in that instance was a discretionary one. They weren't compelled by a court order, although we had commenced proceedings. They weren't necessarily compelled by a court order, and there were no guarantees that we were ultimately going to be successful. But I think the outcome in this case is demonstrative of the fact that with the right support behind someone and the right, I guess, moral high ground, persuasion can be obtained.
Gee, it makes you wonder what's going to happen with those churches and charitable agencies who are taking on some of the Wall Street banks over the derivatives crisis, doesn't it? Because that is almost a carbon copy, writ small, of the derivatives crisis. Yeah. That is, they went and offered products to charities, councils in Australia, churches, invested in products that the salesmen of the products knew at the time were not the gilt-edged investments that they were being offered as.
Yeah, certainly. We've got...
You're not optimistic that moral suasion will hold.
Well, I think we're playing with a little bit bigger chips in that end of town. But I guess the story that I wanted to get across is that people out there who are in those situations shouldn't, I guess, bury their head in the sand and hope that it'll all go away.
Yeah.
But also they shouldn't be in despair, because if they come to the right places and they can get the right support, and there are plenty of sources of legal support out there, the people might be able to achieve an outcome that they can live with.
You had another example too that you drew. Let's talk about government agencies. Centrelink is a constant problem for people. Centrelink is one of those agencies that now it seems to be a behemoth. It just seems to be everything is sucked up into the maw of Centrelink. And people get quite intimidated by dealing with government bureaucracies.
They think, definitely.
If I go in here and I give them my form, I am in some way surrendering who I am, and I've just got to take everything they say at face value.
And they make a note of everything you say, good or bad. And it's used against you at one point in time if you've said the wrong thing. Centrelink, I guess, is a giant, like you say, John, in terms of fear that people might have, because I guess there's been a bit of a track record with Centrelink. And I don't say this that Centrelink doesn't do the right thing. Certainly it does.
Well, certainly many of the people in Centrelink are caught between a rock and a hard place, aren't they? They actually may be in those jobs for the best of motives, but they are driven by criteria which come from the federal government at a very impersonal level, high up, and drive them to interpret their job in a certain way. Their managers are driven by criteria which may not relate necessarily to the good of the individual who comes.
Yeah, and sometimes not through any intention, but more so through lack of education. I don't mean lack of intelligence, but lack of education. Some people who go to Centrelink don't, I guess, assist in the process in terms of their revelation of some of the facts. And that leads me to, I remember a case I dealt with. There was a lady who came to see us from, she was a Syrian lady, and she moved here under an arranged marriage with an Australian citizen. They stayed together for a few years, and they had two small children together. But shortly after the second child was born, he was into drink and drugs, and the relationship broke down quite dramatically. She had told Centrelink that she was separated from him, and she started to claim a single parenting pension, to which she was completely entitled to. 10 years later, Centrelink sent her a letter saying, "We don't think that you are entitled to have been able to get this single parenting pension because we think you're still with your husband." And so they sent her a letter saying, "You owe us $110,000.
Oh, my goodness.
This is a lady who had no friends, no family here. She was depressed. She was isolated. Her children were having trouble with their self-esteem because of the relationship breakdown between their parents. She didn't know anyone. She couldn't speak the language very well at all. She came to us and she brought us this letter, and she was completely helpless. We sat down with her and we realised that certainly she had, I guess, the evidence, the ammunition, to be able to prove what it is that she said had happened, and that is that the relationship had broken down 10 years beforehand. The problem is she hadn't been able to effectively communicate that to Centrelink, which had led them on the path to issuing her with the demand. Now, money's one thing, but the difficulty that people have with Centrelink is Centrelink, by its very nature, because it's the Commonwealth, or an agency of the Commonwealth, when someone obtains money from the Commonwealth, which they're not supposed to, the courts are required to step in, and the Director of Public Prosecutions is required to take proceedings of a criminal nature against that individual. And in terms of the court's positions, they say in instances where Centrelink or obtaining a benefit from the Commonwealth by deception is involved, the starting point, even if you don't have a criminal record of any kind beforehand, the starting point is full-time jail. So we had a situation where this lady, through innocent miscommunication, was clutching a debt of $110,000, and if convicted, she would have faced a period of some years in jail. So we sent one of our solicitors along to a hearing before the Social Security's Appeals Tribunal, and she was quite a confident solicitor. She knew she had the facts on her side. The client, however, didn't get the best of hearings there, and ultimately the decision went against her. And so the client was obviously devastated, thinking that she was going to go to jail, she was never going to be able to pay this money back, the whole future ahead was completely glim. At that point, we decided to speak to the husband, who had, up until that point, completely refused to talk to us. And we said to him, "If you don't talk to us now, your kids are not going to see their mother for about 5 years." And eventually he was persuaded. We had a great barrister assisting us for free. And eventually the husband was persuaded to help us. And so we worked very hard, and we put together about 30 statements from friends and family members on the husband's side. We took videos, we got records from overseas in Syria, and ultimately, just before on the eve of the hearing in the appeals court, Centrelink decided that it would accept this as evidence, and it withdrew the debt and withdrew the demand and closed the proceedings. So a good outcome for her, but not one without substantial grief. And I guess the lesson to be learned there is you have to be very careful when dealing with a government agency, because, like you say, often not because of a will of the government agency, but because of its lack of discretion in terms of taking
things. It's trapped by its own legislative framework.
Precisely. Yes. You can end up very far down the track with very few exit doors open to you.
Do you find that many of the people who come along to you are in the position simply because of ignorance? That is, they thought they were doing the right thing.
Definitely. And that's where I say it's not lack of intelligence, but rather simply lack of education. Government processes are extremely complex. That's why lawyers get paid so much to deal with them.
Luke Geary, it's been terrific to have you along to give us a couple of examples from the coalface of just how people find the world of the law and a world that all of us have to deal with can be so difficult. But it's also good to know that there are people around who can help find a way through. And this is the point I'd like to raise with you, dear listeners. If you have any issues that are troubling you on this sort of matter, drop us a line or give us a call at Sunday nights on at the ABC. You can 994 GPO in Sydney, drop us a line Sunday nights, and if there are issues that you'd like Luke to express a view on, in the most general terms, point you in the direction of help and assistance, then Luke will be back with us in 3 or 4 weeks' time to perhaps share some more observations from the world of the law and just the work that he's engaged in day to day, helping people with all sorts of problems at the coalface, some large, some small, but all vitally important for each of them. Luke, you mentioned Salvos Legal at the start and your work with Salvos Legal and your initiative here. You said it started around the Sydney area. Is it branching
where
out?
Where to next? Well, look, as soon as we can afford it, John, and my hope is by the end of this financial year, if the work of Salvos Legal, that is the commercial property law firm, so if enough mums and dads get out there and say for their conveyancing, we'd like Salvos Legal to do that for us, if we can generate enough business there, we'll be able to have the funds to open up a new practice in Canberra and southern New South Wales to be able to service those rural areas in the southern tip of New South Wales and throughout the ACT.
Luke Geary, thanks so much for joining us on Sunday night.